all of your different websites you mentioned on the show page, so folks want to try some of the products, they can just click on there and they'll just go right there. You take care of yourself and say hi to the your wife and thank her for taking good care of you.
I will, thank you.
You know, all right. See you soon.
Thank you.
Bye. Dr. William Wong, who's a big fan of Ray Pete's, and Ray Pete heard that.
We are listener supported. One Radio Network.
Well, here we go. Here it would be the third Tuesday, and that would bring us to a time when we're grateful to have the lovely and talented Dr. Ray Pete on the air on the third Tuesday, and as long as the creeks don't rise, he said, we'll do it. He's a PhD, University of Oregon, specialization in physiology. Started working with hormones back in 68. Whoa, that's when I started radio. In 68 in Armed Forces Radio, he was starting his work on hormones. Wrote his dissertation in 72. He's got a great newsletter that comes out a couple times a month that you have a little link there on the show page that you can get Dr. Pete's newsletter, and it's great to talk to him from time to time. If you have an email for him, question patrick@oneradionetwork.com, and out to the left coast, Dr. Pete, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you doing there?
Very good. It has started raining, winter weather setting in already.
Uh-huh. You're in Oregon, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You get a lot of rain there?
Yeah. The weather has been pretty variable, but we're back to the old continuous rain, it looks like. Mm-hmm. The ocean is warming up, and when that happens, we get extra rain. Humid air condenses.
I saw the... Go ahead.
The nighttime rain is the traditional northwest weather, but we had been changing over the last 30 or 40 years until it looked more like a Midwest climate. Summer rain and drier winters. But I think we're back to the old rain in the winter, night and winter.
I saw with the Farmer's Almanac, they use sunspots, and they're predicting a cold and woolly winter this year for a lot of the country. We'll see how accurate that is.
I think the sun and the submarine volcanoes are really the important thing changing the weather over the long term, rather than carbon dioxide.
Yeah, submarine volcanoes?
The Pacific is really pretty full of volcanoes that actually are warming the ocean, and they have cycles like sunspot cycles.
Oh. So they put out a lot of heat down there, and they're going on, and we don't really know they're spitting up.
Yeah, and they're teeming with life. Primitive life forms that can live at extremely high temperatures.
And so when the ocean's warm, and that causes all kinds of things to happen in the jet stream, and weather changes more dramatically.
It changes the ocean currents.
It's hard to imagine the carbon dioxide is like the devil. I mean, we want to keep more carbon dioxide in us by not breathing so fast.
One of the anti-climate change people says. He gets up on a box and lectures in London. He has a little sign that says, carbon dioxide is the gas of life.
Many people believe that. Many people, gosh, how could you make it so, I don't know, it's so political stuff. Who knows, right, what's going on with all that? Well, Dr. Ray Pete is probably one of the few well-known people, well-credentialed people, that got milk. You know, he's got that little white mustache thing. And you've been drinking milk for a long time now, and you do good with it.
There were times, like when I was living in Mexico City, when it was hard to get good milk, the rich people would send their maids out at dawn to buy up all of the good milk. And so for 3 or 4 years, I went very light on milk. But the rest of my life, I've been a big milk drinker, gallon a day.
You still doing that much, a gallon a day?
No, about 2.5 quarts, I think, averaging now.
Wow. We had an Ayurvedic doctor on a couple of weeks ago. And she's a Ayurveda, as you know, you probably do know, they've been a great proponent of drinking milk for a long time, thousands of years, right? I want to read you something out of her book. I think you'll find it fun. Her name is Marianne Tittlebaum. She's a DC, but we found her very, very just, I don't know, very credible. She says dairy is perhaps the most misunderstood of all food groups. The ancient doctors said that every food you eat spends 3 to 5 days in each tissue before progressing to the next. There are, as discussed earlier, 7 tissues: blood, plasma, blood, muscle, fat, bone marrow, and reproductive fluids. This means that the food you eat today can sometimes won't nourish everything, all 7 tissues, for about a month or so. The only exception to the rule is milk. It nourishes all 7 tissues in one day. Thus, milk is seen as one of the most nourishing foods of all life. This is why babies can live exclusively off milk for the first year of their life. Do you think that's accurate with the going through all the tissues like that in one day?
I think some of that is historical metaphor, but there is some basis to it, undoubtedly, because it's now known that every tissue has its rate of protein turnover, and as your nutrients change, the food you eat guides the turnover of the proteins so that you get proteins suitable for the type of food you're eating. And every tissue, like bone, is extremely slow to turn over its, most of its substance. Your liver is very fast. The skin and intestine are extremely fast, just a few days, and they're completely remade. The heart has a slower rate of protein turnover, but everything, the mitochondria, the energy-producing apparatus is churning over constantly, but at its own rate. And I think, in general, the faster a tissue turns over, because it's kept warm and well-nourished and unstressed, high stress will make you turn over your thymus gland and muscles and skin very fast, but in a destructive way. But a good, warm, well-fed condition, you do have a constant turnover and renewal of your tissues. It's like a streaming. New cells are being born as the old ones are being eaten up, and so you clean out the debris at a regular pace according to the tissue.
Interesting. I agree with you. I think that it's been my experience in the old Ayurvedic texts, which obviously is where this came from. They began, at some point, they often got often very poetic, right? And very, you know, beautiful words. And they sometimes would expound a bit, or maybe say, exaggerate a bit on the benefits of stuff. You know what I'm saying? And historically, I think you nailed that. Not to say it's not true, but they were very poetic and philosophical and spiritual about the approaching of different things. And I know one thing that I read years ago, they're big fans of ghee rather than butter. And I read one book where this fellow said, this sage, well, if you have 100-year-old ghee, it'll cure anything. You know, that kind of thing. They would make these kinds of statements. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, so I think your point is well taken about the historical, but fascinating. Now, she's a big fan, and Ayurveda has always been a big fan of, not a big fan, but actually saying this is the best way, is to boil the milk. Boil the milk for several reasons. I think it helps with the fat absorption, and also if you have raw milk, maybe gets rid of any little buggies. And they put cardamom and cinnamon in there to help do some things that I'll find it in here. What about you? Do you think, have you found any benefit in the boiling milk? Have you ever done that?
Oh sure. Living outside of Mexico City, where they have cows or goats, that's the custom. Everyone puts a big pot of milk on in the morning and brings it to a boil, and that usually they skim off the fat that rises and make special dishes out of that, or else feed it to the cats and chickens.
I wonder why you would do that. Wouldn't that fat be good?
Yeah, if a person likes it, they have dishes and puddings and things that they make out of it, to use it as a sauce on tacos and such.
Now, would there be any benefit to our listeners who can't have access to raw cow's or goat's milk to boil like an organic grass-fed milk they could get at the Whole Foods or something?
Surprisingly, the damage nutritionally is very small. It oxidizes some of the vitamin A and a tiny bit of the vitamin C, but milk is still basically the best source of all of the nutrients when you compare it to for the number of calories and protein in it. It has all of the nutrients except iron.
How about the cardamom and cinnamon thing? Any thoughts on that?
They each has its medical uses. I haven't been a big fan of them. Mexicans put cinnamon on their chocolate drink generally.
What about this A1 and A2 milk? That's been going around for years, and theoretically the A2 milk, I guess, is supposed to be the most easily digestible. What is that from the Jerseys or the Holsteins? Let's see. No, A1 is found in the Holsteins, and then A2 is more in the Jerseys or the Guernseys.
When I was little, we had a Holstein, and then when I was about 8 or 9, we got a Jersey, which we had for 10 or 15 years, and I don't really see any difference, and I think a lot of it is just marketing to sell something for a higher price if you have the right kind of cow.
And Ayurveda says that the goat's milk is good. It's an excellent source, but it's just a little bit higher choice for cow's milk. That's interesting. Do you agree with that? Or do you know?
Well,
you have a theory, opinion.
My own preference is for cow's milk, just because I'm more familiar with that. When I was in the first or second grade, we had a Holstein, and the neighbors had goats, and their goat milk was very strong smelling, and so I learned to prefer cow's milk. But if you handle the goats right, the goat milk will taste as good as cow's milk.
So that's you say you're drinking still a couple quarts a day. That must be you find that's a lot of food for you, and that provides a lot of your nutrition.
Milk has always the last 40 years has been the bulk of my daily food. When I would drink a gallon a day, I would maybe have a couple of quarts of orange juice and some cheese or sardines or something for a supper snack, and eggs for breakfast.
And that keeps you going. That would keep you going without losing, you know, keep your muscles going. How about you now? Let's see, if I recall, your revolutions around the sun, which is also called age, you are 80, 83?
Yeah, 83. Well, in October 83.
83 in October. Yeah, I'm going to be 73 revolutions in November. We're about 10 years apart. Have you, what has been your experience? I know you paint. Do you have to do other things? Have you found to keep your muscles from, what's that word they use for it? They always have a word, Doc.
Sarcopenia.
Sarcopenia, yeah. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I noticed after about 10 years of just sitting around studying that my shoulders got less rounded muscles. Mm-hmm. I could see in photographs that my shoulder muscles were smaller because I wasn't working regularly. But just moving around, my leg muscles have stayed huge after not going skiing, for example, for 10 years. Someone told me that my leg muscles must be getting weak from just sitting around reading all the time. But I tested myself doing one-legged sit-ups, and every 10 years I would do 10 one-legged sit-ups, and didn't notice a significant dropping off with time. Mm-hmm. I haven't done it for 15 years, though. I don't know whether I could still do 10. Mm.
Do you do any other kind of exercise regularly?
No, just every 10 years I would test myself.
That's right. How often do you exercise? Oh, every 10 years. I knew. That's great. That's great. So you like orange juice, huh? You still like orange juice?
Oh yeah, when good stuff is available. Mm-hmm. It should be thoroughly ripened. The commercial stuff, they are used to selling unripe oranges, and so if they accidentally get ripe oranges, they add acetic acid to it. A lot of the, for example, the concentrated or canned varieties mm-hmm. very often have acid added, but mm-hmm. the acid etches the enamel off your teeth, so yeah. Ripe oranges are safer in every way. Mm.
So you would want to rinse out your mouth with clear water after orange juice?
Mm-hmm. Clear water, or maybe even baking soda if it's very acidic.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about taking baking soda regularly? Some people advocate that, a quarter teaspoon or stuff. Do you think there's any value to that?
I know people who do as much as a teaspoon two or three times a day and mm-hmm. think it improves their endurance and strength. Mm. But even a fourth of a teaspoon two or three times a day, people say that it helps reduce inflammation. And I know people who used to get swollen legs when taking a long airplane trip. When they took a teaspoon of baking soda in water before getting on the plane, they stopped having the swollen feet.
Well, what's going on there, can you surmise what you think metabolically is happening with the baking soda, sodium bicarbonate?
The sodium lowers your aldosterone very quickly, and aldosterone is a general stress hormone that tends to go up with cortisol, which damages tissues. But aldosterone causes a shift towards inflammation and fibrosis. So the chronic elevation of aldosterone leads to heart disease and circulatory disease and kidney disease. So chronic intake of a little extra sodium, such as you get with small doses of baking soda, that has a chronic anti-stress effect, keeping your aldosterone lower. And that lets you lose the sodium fairly quickly. And the bicarbonate part is quickly changed. There's an enzyme, carbonic anhydrase, that changes carbon dioxide to bicarbonate and bicarbonate back into carbon dioxide. And at the surface of your cell, when you're losing the sodium through your kidneys, your cells change bicarbonate into carbon dioxide, which is more soluble in the living cell. So it goes out of your blood more or less at the same rate that the sodium is leaving your blood. Bicarbonate into your cells, sodium out of your body. So what it amounts to is the same as breathing a little extra carbon dioxide, or failing to hyperventilate. And low thyroid people hyperventilate and blow away the carbon dioxide they should be keeping in their cells.
Mm-hmm.
And so the supplement of baking soda is imitating to a degree the normal thyroid function, keeping your cells more charged with carbon dioxide, which is a stabilizing thing that has tremendous ramifications everywhere. It when you are at a high altitude, there's less oxygen, and the oxygen normally is in your lungs, it exchanges with carbon dioxide. And so at sea level, high oxygen pressure pushes more carbon dioxide out of your blood. At a high altitude, the lower oxygen tension allows you to retain more carbon dioxide. And people have less dementia, heart disease, and cancer at very high altitudes and live longer. And that's very likely mostly the effect of retaining the proper amount of carbon dioxide. And so if you at moderate altitude, if you're breathing more carbon dioxide, like adding a supplement, it can be with baking soda, that extra carbon dioxide is to some degree imitating a high altitude or a better thyroid functioning.
Fascinating. So the low thyroid folks, do they tend to breathe more, have more breaths per minute, and then have less carbon dioxide, which we know is good? Is that right?
Well, relative to how much oxygen they need, because the oxygen requirement is very low in a low thyroid person, so they don't need to move very much air. A quart of oxygen will last a low thyroid person maybe minutes, where a high thyroid person would be gone in seconds. I've seen it in labs where we were practicing doing the basal metabolic rate test by a rate of consuming oxygen. And for example, the typical old-fashioned machine contains 2 liters of oxygen, and I didn't know that I was hyperthyroid. I didn't have any signs of hyperthyroidism, but in the standard test, I emptied the machine in half the allotted time. So it was the tracing on the graph paper was almost a vertical line, where it was supposed to be about a 45 degree angle to the right. According to the standards, I was about 4 times the normal oxygen consuming rate, which a doctor would say, oh, that's dangerous hyperthyroidism, but I was fine, no health problems at all.
Very interesting. Do you put much stock in taking the temperature to gauge thyroid function?
Yeah, when you're producing energy at a high rate, say 150% of of the average. You're maintaining your blood sugar level because you're using the sugar efficiently, not wasting any. The hypothyroid person wastes sugar at a terrible rate because they aren't using oxygen properly. So if you're using sugar efficiently, that means you don't experience hypoglycemia, and so you don't produce very much adrenaline to regulate your blood sugar, and so your adrenaline level is low, your stress level is low, and everything metabolically is running efficiently. You're turning over your proteins, but in a renewal way rather than a stress produced way.
Here's an email from Beth about thyroid, so I thought I'd throw it right in there. Dr. Ray Pete, do you think fluoride and chloride in a tap water and bromide in breads are having a major effect on our thyroids?
Yeah, I didn't know they were still putting bromide in bread.
I don't think they are generally, but maybe this lady knows.
Yeah, it isn't good if it's there. It should be avoided. And fluoride, I think, I was for a while using a supplement of T3, the active thyroid hormone. And when I would go to San Francisco or an area where they have fluoridated water, I would get a migraine headache. And I looked up the amount of fluoride ions in water and the amount of T3, the number of the potential sites for the fluoride to stick to, and a glass of fluoridated water is enough to knock out a day's portion of the active thyroid hormone. And
wow.
Since I was using that active thyroid hormone, it was very quick and very noticeable that if I drank fluoridated water, for example, in my coffee or orange juice, I would get a migraine from extreme hypothyroidism.
Cynthia writes in, I take 60 milligrams, one grain of natural thyroid every day. It seems my TSH levels are normal, one or two. My doctor likes that. Does Dr. Pete think that if I just keep doing this, that my thyroid will never be able to make this what it needs to on its own?
I've seen several people who were hypothyroid who, when they took the amount that brought their oxygen consumption up to the right level, had recovery of their own thyroid function and could stop taking it. It doesn't happen very often, but I've seen several people who cured their low thyroid by supplementing thyroid.
So explain what you mean, getting the oxygen level. How do we know? How would you know?
Well, if you're sick with low thyroid, you have a variety of symptoms. And these individuals responded to supplementing their thyroid the way any hypothyroid person does. But in a few cases, they were able to maintain their metabolic rate and stop taking the thyroid because the thyroid had restored, the supplement had restored their anti-stress metabolism, lowered the adrenaline and cortisol, and allowed the tissue to start metabolizing by itself and producing its own thyroid. But usually a person's body is loaded up with anti-thyroid substances, polyunsaturated fats built right into the structure of the cell, not only in the fat tissue, but in their muscles and brain and so on, especially after the age of 20, the tissues start building polyunsaturated fats right into the structure. And when you're under stress, you release some of those polyunsaturated fats into your bloodstream, where they interfere with thyroid function. So the average person in their 20s or 30s or older needs to, if they're hypothyroid, they benefit from taking a supplement for at least a few years until they can change the composition of their body.
Are they better off to take the lowest possible amount when they're doing that? I mean, just to make it work, to help it make it work on its own?
If you happen to take too much, you'll get breathless, consume too much oxygen. I've done it many times, and just standing up to answer the telephone, I would start panting and had to cut back on my thyroid. Mm-hmm. But I've seen people, well, on myself, for example, when I was judging just by how I felt, I would supplement the thyroid. And one morning I noticed I had dents in my throat beside my Adam's apple, where the thyroid gland had been, about a dent about the size of my finger, pressed into my throat. And I realized I had shrunk my thyroid gland. So I stopped taking the quick-acting T3. The next morning, my neck was smooth.
Wow.
And I've seen several people who were taking too much thyroid and shrank their gland. And in just one or two days, it comes back massively.
If one is taking some thyroid meds, as we call them, what's the role of taking supplemental iodine if you're not taking a thyroid, or if you are?
Foods such as milk and eggs always contain thyroid, even though seafood is the known reliable source of trace minerals, selenium and iodine particularly. But since thyroid is a fertility hormone, animals can't produce eggs and milk if they're very hypothyroid. You're assured that milk and eggs will always contain some iodine and some equivalent thyroid-supporting substance. There was a study back when iodine was sometimes used as a dough conditioner instead of bromine. And at that time, the average American diet contained several times the ideal amount of iodine, and it has been about 60 or 70 years since there were hypothyroid low iodine areas in the United States, like the Great Lakes region was a famous greater belt. But since the food technology has started using so much iodine, there hasn't been any iodine deficiency zone in the U.S. And what happens if you take even twice, two or three or four times the amount needed by the body, you start interfering with the function of the gland. Often people supplement more than a milligram, up to as much as 10 milligrams a day, and that seriously damages the thyroid. Every couple of months, hear from someone who has damaged their thyroid by taking several milligrams a day of iodine.
Is that a lot, milligrams? I know.
The required amount is about a tenth to a fifth of a milligram per day. And taking a half a milligram per day, chronically, looking at a big population, that's enough to increase the incidence of thyroiditis and eventually thyroid cancer.
So it sounds like what I'm hearing you saying is, with some good foods, milk or eggs, and that we're going to get or fish, we're going to get enough
And it's seriously dangerous in the long run to supplement too much iodine.
Yeah, yeah. I do really well, and others have too. They've mentioned with this, you know, the salmon you can get, you know, the little thin slices. What do you call that? I guess smoked salmon and things like that. You think that's a generally good food?
Yeah, it's nutritious, but you can overload on polyunsaturated fat if you eat salmon all the time.
Oh, there's PUFAs in salmon?
Oh yeah, a lot of PUFA.
Really? What are they doing there? I thought that's a fish.
Yeah, the cold water fish eat algae, and the algae is the source of
the PUFAs.
PUFA. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So you tend to, you like to gravitate more towards a warm water fish.
Yeah, as far as it's available, but a small amount. There are some low-fat fish that come from pretty cold waters, cod and sole are the lowest-fat fish that I know of, and I think they're safer than salmon if you're going to eat fish every week.
Oh, really? Okay, can you stay right there? We're going to take a little break here. Patrick Timpone. OneRadioNetwork.com. One of the most powerful antioxidants ever is actually Brown's gas. Well, hydrogen, and the machine that we have, the AquaCure machine, makes Brown's gas, which is, it's kind of different than actual molecular hydrogen, Brown's gas, and that's what George's machine makes, the one that we promote. It's very quiet, and you can bubble in the water and then breathe it, and they have a whole little setup there, which is digital, and depending on your body weight, you know exactly how much to put in there. You just dial that in, and when you do just the water, you can just dial in 100% of the Brown's gas going into the water, drink the water, and then if you're going to drink it and make water at the same time, it's fine, because you'll still make plenty of hydrogen in the water. It's just it's a fascinating, most abundant just gas or thing in the universe, hydrogen. It's just like, I think 96% of everything that's out there. So we have a great little machine that we promote, and if you use promo code OneRadio, you get a 10%. And look upon it as an investment in your health. They're a couple $1,000, but this thing has got a lifetime warranty, and also a 1 year. No questions asked money back if you don't like it. Now that's pretty cool. Lots of safety features that most of the hydrogen Brown's gas machines do not have, and it's important, because hydrogen, molecular hydrogen, and making Brown's gas, it's a very energetic substance, let me put it like that. I mean, you can do hydrogen cars and hydrogen whatever. You know, it's volatile, so you got to be careful with it. But your body likes it. It's one of the biggest antioxidants and anti-inflammatory. Good things are going in my body with lower inflammation. I can feel it. I can just feel it. I don't know why. I just feel more comfortable in my body after breathing this gas. It's a nice thing. And here's more on it from George, who makes the machine. This was previously with George Wiseman about his AquaCure machine making hydrogen, gas, and water out of the same hose. Listen.
The body accepts that gas and uses it to heal everything. It's like the fountain of youth. It's astonishing the amount of ailments. In fact, in scientific studies, and they have over 1,000 scientific studies now, they are showing that it either helps the body heal directly or indirectly from virtually every ailment that ails any water-based life form. But it works just as well on animals and plants and lizards and birds and everybody.
And you're saying this because this machine called the AquaCure split into 5 different parts.
6.
I got hydrogen, oxygen, electro, enhanced water, water vapors, monatomic hydrogen. What else?
And monatomic oxygen.
Oh, the monooxygen. And that's what your machine does? It splits it?
Yes, it makes that mixture inside the machine. And all that comes out a single hose. The same hose.
Gas?
As a gas, in gaseous form, yes.
And you breathe it or you put it in water?
So if you bubble the Brown's gas into this water, into, let's say, distilled water, it will go to a negative ORP. And when you drink that, it actually gives your body an electrical energy, these electrons. Instead of sucking energy from you, it gives it. So you can have water that is healthful and not healthful just by the energy that's in the water.
You want to get one? Me too. Ours is on the way. Check this out. Lifetime warranty on the machine itself, and then a 1 year, no questions asked, money back guarantee if you like the machine within a year. I mean, have you ever heard of a warranty like that? The AquaCure. Use promo code ONERADIO, promo code ONERADIO for a 10% discount. It's in our store on OneRadioNetwork.com. And keep in mind the idea of dehydration, it's really the lack of hydrogen. Dehydration really helps your body to become hydrated. Really nice machines. Wayne Blakely is with us, and he makes the Living Streams products. There's two different Bifidos. Let's talk about the straight product that is Bifido, and then there's Bifido 2. What is the Bifido used for?
The Bifido is used as a probiotic nutrient, which has curcumin in it and turmeric in it, which has certain minerals and nutrients in them that helps the body, especially absorption of your food. Curcumin is the most researched supplement in the world. The researchers don't really understand how curcumin works in the body. And curcumin is very hard to digest in the digestive tract. So we pre-digest the curcumin, which has, we buy our curcumin from India because it has a mineral in it called yttrium. And we use the bacteria to break down the yttrium, the correct bacteria to break down the yttrium so our body can assimilate it so we can absorb our food correctly. And it stops plaque in the body.
Pretty cool stuff, isn't it? Wayne's on it. And the lack of bacteria in the soil in this country is the whole issue why yttrium is in short supply. Very unique products. Living Streams. He's talking about the Bifido, and it's in our store on OneRadioNetwork.com. The Ayurveda lady that was on the show, we're going to have her back on, Dr. Teitelbaum. She was really, really big on moringa, too, as a an incredible tree, nutrient, herb, whatever you want to call it. And if you want to get a real natural way, full-fledged way, Wayne has a moringa product that's in a probiotic, very easy to absorb, and you get a big bottle of it, and you can drink a lot of it. And moringa, it's pretty amazing what's going on with moringa. So, fun things are all in our store. Excuse me, all in our store on One Radio Network. Had to cough there. If you would like to get more information, you can talk to Wayne's protege or helper, Marilyn, 360-912-2981. 360-912-2981. She can give you more insights on this or that, or, you know, what is good for. We have some things for perimenopause, and Wayne's very careful. He doesn't say a lot of stuff because, oh, you know, the FDNA, they get all carried away, can't make any claims, and I understand. So, but Marilyn can give you some information. She doesn't do medical advice, neither do I, or nobody on our guest list ever do medical advice. It's all up to you. But anyway, these probiotics work like probiotics are supposed to. Living Streams, OneRadioNetwork.com.
We talk about your health, wealth, and well-being on OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, it's an honor to have Dr. Ray Peet on our show, and he's consented to come on the third Tuesday, and we're here. So, Dr. Peet, thanks so much for coming on from time to time. People like you. people like you. You're a rock star around here. They just like you. What do you know about vagal syncope? An emailer is talking about the vagus nerve gets activated due to stressors, the heart rate slows, blood pressure drops, blood vessels in the legs can dilate, the blood pools in the lower part flowing to the brain, and maybe nausea and things like that. And this lady, Mona, wants to know that what besides the stressor is causing the vagus nerve to react so, there has to be more to it than simply being a response to being hot, emotional, scared when in a normal life setting.
Low thyroid people tend in that direction.
Oh.
And I wrote some newsletters a few years ago on shock, and the history of shock goes back a few hundred years, but it really became a major aspect of physiology just a little over 100 years ago, beginning of the 20th century, when one of the pioneers was George Washington Crile, whose son at the Cleveland Clinic, which was founded by G.W. Crile the first. The son was a pioneer in both thyroid therapy and breast cancer treatment. He innovated the lumpectomy rather than the horrible radical mastectomy, and he practically eliminated thyroid surgery, went from over 1,000 surgeries a year in the clinic to just about a dozen by understanding how the thyroid can be treated. But his father was the real pioneer that led to that understanding of the thyroid, and his thyroid work grew out of his surgical experiments, in which he really explained more than anyone else what shock is and how the vagus nerve governs shock. And what happens in shock is that signals are sent to all of your body cells, turning off the ability to use oxygen. And the use of oxygen is what thyroid is in control of. The more thyroid you have, the more oxygen your cells can use. And within a broad range, that means that your metabolism becomes more and more efficient as you use more oxygen. So the low thyroid person is wasting their energy. But in shock, it's even worse than hypothyroidism. It simply turns off the mechanism for burning, for using oxygen and burning any fuel. And so it imitates death, basically. When a person in shock is cut, their blood stays bright red. They aren't using the oxygen in their blood because the tissue is simply switched off metabolically. It's like turning off a thyroid in a nervous or electrical way rather than a chemical way. And the George Washington Crile showed that stimulating the vagus nerve was the basic signal for turning on shock. Whether it was caused by loss of blood or pain or fright or whatever, the signals through the vagus system were able to switch off basically the life process temporarily. And that process is easier to trigger the lower your thyroid function is. You become more of a vagal organism when your thyroid is lower. But people generally, if they're going to keep functioning at all, they compensate for that exaggerated activity of the vagal nervous system by pumping out extra adrenaline. Their adrenal glands become overactive, and they run as much as 40 or 50 times the normal amount of adrenaline production, compensating for that abnormal activity of the vagal opposing system. The parasympathetic system is the vagal system, and the adrenaline system is the sympathetic nervous system. And surprisingly, many people are running with both sides of their autonomic nervous system running at an extremely high rate. And if something interferes with their production of adrenaline and sympathetic activity, then they drop into the vagal state and move toward shock, fainting, for example.
My goodness. Well, a lot of questions there. So this Kyle, is that K-Y-L-E? And this work seems, it kind of feels like this is long ago.
I didn't understand the question.
Kyle, this work with G.W. Kyle, was this long ago?
Kyle, C-R-I-L-E.
Oh, C-R-I-L-E. Oh, Carl, okay.
Carlisle,
yeah. Long time ago?
The senior Kyle died, I think, in the 1940s, and the junior died not long ago in the 90s, I think.
Mm-hmm. And what did he do to lower the all this these surgeries? That he went from thousands to a handful? What did he do?
Supplementing thyroid, basically.
Oh, he just gave supplemental thyroid.
Things they were calling thyroid cancer. Mm-hmm. It was just a minor condition that he could turn off just by giving them a full replacement dose of thyroid.
Mm, really? Was he using TSH and all that as a metric?
No, not at all.
No.
TSH measurement came in later, really.
Mm-hmm.
And he was measuring it enough to realize that people developing these symptoms of thyroid cancer, nodules and so on, were experiencing the same condition that iodine supplementers experience, with a very high TSH. And so he understood that TSH was driving towards thyroiditis and eventually thyroid cancer. And so he would give usually 3 or 4 grains of Armour thyroid, sufficient to lower the TSH to 0. And then these people, without thyroidectomy, or maybe just partial removal of the cancerous part, would live a normal life.
My
just
goodness.
Keeping their TSH down so that any surviving cancer cells wouldn't be stimulated by the TSH.
My goodness. 3 or 4 grains. Now, a grain is 60 milligrams. I mean, that's a lot, isn't it?
2 grains was the average dose for just the run-of-the-mill.
Was it?
Low thyroid, middle-aged person. But sometimes, just to have good functioning, some people took 3 or 4 or even 5 grains. The Armour company sold tablets of 5 grains.
Really?
And veterinarians found that that was the right dose for Cocker Spaniels and a couple of breeds of dogs needed about 5 grains a day, and quite a few people, they sold bottles of 505 grain tablets for $10 or so. I've seen a few people who needed more than 5 grains, 10 or 15 grains a day to cure their problem, and then they would settle in on 4 or 5 grains a day for maintenance.
My goodness, it seems like a very high dose what we hear around, but I guess. So how did this Carlisle, how did he judge the dosage if he wasn't using the labs?
The basal metabolic rate was still in use through the 1940s and into the 50s. Mm-hmm. Then the chemical, the first test was a blood test called protein-bound iodine.
Mm-hmm.
Came in just around the same time that Synthroid came on the market.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And as it turned out 20 years later that it was an absolute meaningless thing. But at the time, I was in junior high at the time, and several of my fat friends said they had learned that they didn't have a glandular problem because the protein-bound iodine showed that they had a fully normal amount of protein-bound iodine in their blood, and so they had discovered that they were just gluttonous.
So they brought they brought this med thing out right when the Synthroid came out. I mean, the test.
Yeah. It really was part of a marketing system.
Those rascals.
Yeah. What they did was blame the problem on the patient rather than supplementing with Armour Thyroid, which was a good, reliable product.
My goodness. So back to Mona, who brought up this whole Vegas. So she might have, on both ends, working overtime with the sympathetic, with the vagus and then the adrenaline, right? How do you lower all that down? Is it just looking after Mr. Thyroid?
Using your temperature and pulse rate, you can come fairly close to the old oxygen consumption test, which that's still the ideal way to prove hypothyroidism, but you can make a very good guess by taking your temperature before you get out of bed in the morning and checking your pulse rate at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
If you're lots of the low thyroid people are running on high adrenaline, which rises during the night, and that tends to push up the cortisol. The adrenaline sometimes will cause 90 or 100 beats per minute heart rate when you're waking up, sometimes following a nightmare. And if the cortisol goes up higher than average, it always tends to rise around dawn. But the higher your cortisol rises, the higher your waking temperature will be. The adrenaline speeds your pulse at dawn. The cortisol raises the temperature and helps to push the heart rate back down by bringing your blood sugar up. So just that one measurement can be ambiguous: high adrenaline, high cortisol, low, both of them. But if you then take your temperature and pulse rate an hour or two after eating, the food will lower your adrenaline, and the daylight and food will lower your cortisol. And very often these people who woke up seeming to have a very normal 75 beats per minute pulse rate and a 98 degree temperature, these people will sometimes drop to a 55 or 60 pulse rate and a 96 or 97 degree temperature at 11 o'clock in the morning.
And what does that tell you if that happens?
That they're super low thyroid.
Ah, okay. So the Broda Barnes thing wasn't kind of sort of right. I mean, if you had a 98, you know, according to Broda Barnes, and you were good, but this whole adrenaline and cortisol thing, you're saying that maybe not.
Hot, humid summers in Eugene, I first started questioning Barnes's temperature measurement. He worked at Fort Collins, Colorado, where it never gets very hot and humid for very long. And I saw that people in this hot and humid weather, even very hypothyroid people, kept a normal temperature. But usually with the normal temperature, they would get a slow pulse rate.
Mm-hmm.
So I started adding the two together, but then I saw that a very stressful nighttime would make both of the indicators sometimes look normal at dawn or waking, and then they would go down on a cool mid-morning or afternoon.
That's fascinating. That's a very, very, very interesting.